My fellow Americans, we have endured a week such as no nation should live through, a time of violence and tragedy.
I think the President of the United States played politics in a period of tragedy and riot.
We have made it very clear we do not want more than our share. We are determined to settle for nothing less than our share.
I deplore the action of the UAW in forcing Ford into this situation. I am sorry that we do not have laws that effectively prevent the use of this kind of bludgeon against the public interest.
I understand our neighbors would wish to turn the clock back to 1947. The fact is, however, that most clocks move forward and not backward.
Hell no!
These are the sounds and voices of a year as WKNR News presents an electronic diary of 1967, a year marked by rioting, by a continuing war and growing protest, by a rise in crime and cost, and by tragedy and triumph. As with all years, there was good and bad. We shall recall both. A summer Sunday for most is one of the good things in life. It's a day for picnics, swimming, golf, a drive in the country, a day with friends and family. July 23rd was a Sunday. In Detroit, it was typical, hot and bright. The Detroit Tigers were only two games out of first place. At the stadium, they played a twin bill with the Yankees. 34,000 watched the games. It's doubtful any remember the day at the ballpark. July 23rd was the day the riot started. One week earlier, 25 persons had died when rioting hit Newark, New Jersey. The summer had seen trouble in some unlikely places: Albany, New York; Waterbury, Connecticut; Waukegan, Illinois; in Cincinnati; Dayton; Toledo, Ohio; in Louisville; Philadelphia; Poughkeepsie; and Phoenix. But after July 23rd, those outbreaks were nearly forgotten. The spark, as always, was a minor incident. It was routine police action, a raid on what Detroiters call a blind pig, an after-hours bar. In this case, on 12th Street, a sleazy strip of pawn shops and bars, a haven for pimps and prostitutes, junkies and gamblers. 85 persons were arrested in that raid. A crowd gathered to watch. There were some shouts, and then a rock through a police car window. The agony began. It was merely a matter of hours before the looting and arson had spread through the city. The first major fire came at 6:30, 3 hours after that routine police raid. A looted shoe store burned. It was the first of 2,000 fires. Along 12th Street, Negro shopkeepers hurriedly scrawled "Soul Brother" on store windows. The relief was temporary. Integrated mobs stole openly. The police stood by. They sealed off 12th Street, hoping to contain the rioting. It didn't work. All available firemen were called to duty. Trying to battle the burgeoning number of blazes became nearly an impossible task. Time after time, they were the targets of bricks and bottles at a fire scene. Later, those bricks and bottles became bullets.
Let's get under cover now, Officer. Move, let's go.
Where did that second fire come from?
We don't know, but they just shot one of our over. Stay under cover.
All uniformed men, stay under cover.
I heard the shot.
And like a plague, it spread, moving west and northwest across Woodward to the east side. It was out of control. At a command post downtown, city officials were joined by Michigan Governor Romney. State police were called in, the National Guard mobilized, and finally, federal troops requested.
As governor of the state of Michigan, I do hereby officially request the immediate deployment of federal troops into Michigan to assist state and local authorities in reestablishing law and order in the city of Detroit. I am joined in this request by Jerome P. Cavanaugh, mayor of the city of Detroit. There is reasonable doubt that we can suppress the existing looting, arson, and sniping without the assistance of federal troops. Time could be of the essence.
It would take 24 hours for those federal troops to get on the streets. There was first a debate over semantics. Should the governor request or recommend? Task Force Detroit was made up of the 101st and 82nd Airborne Division's combat veterans. They waited outside the city while Presidential Assistant Cyrus Vance viewed the burning city and vacillated.
The regular Army troops are assembled in reserve positions at the fairgrounds, adjacent to the airport, and in the vicinity of the Detroit City Airport.
At midnight Monday, the president went on the networks.
Law enforcement is a local matter. It is the responsibility of local officials and the governors of the respective states. The federal government should not intervene except in the most extraordinary circumstances. The fact of the matter, however, is that law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan. Pillage, looting, murder, and arson have nothing to do with civil rights.
During his address, the president made it quite clear Michigan's governor had admitted a lack of control. He mentioned the governor 13 times, and Governor Romney replied,
I think the president of the United States played politics in a period of tragedy and riot. I don't think there's any question but that if we'd have had the federal troops on the streets before dark Monday, that it would have had an effect.
But the troops did move in. They went to the city's east side. It was the second time in a quarter of a century that federal troops had been dispatched to quell a riot. Ironically, the other time was 1943 in Detroit. On the west side, the battle raged. The looting had dwindled. There was little left to loot. Middle-class Negro neighborhoods became havens for snipers. Patton tanks and other armored equipment rolled through city streets. Overhead, helicopters and reconnaissance planes flew swiftly through billowing clouds of acrid smoke. At one point, we crouched in the shadow of the General Motors building to record the sounds of a city at war.
Those shots are being fired on 12th Street. Two tanks have just moved into that area. Those first shots you heard were 50 caliber. The last apparently either from Detroit police, state police, perhaps National Guardsmen. This area full of snipers tonight. The vehicle sounds in the background are the tanks, armored personnel carriers. That would sound more like a sniper shot, the ones we've just heard. They're firing bullet bullets. Apparently moving more troops in. I'm looking up now, a truck of troopers coming in. This occurred just as we moved down from the 12th and Euclid area where we were in with the guard. Four casualties had to be moved out there. And that's the sound you're hearing all over Detroit this evening. In these areas that have been hit by earlier sniping, that one closer, 12th Street, which has been the scene since Sunday of the worst of the violence in Detroit, and where it flared anew again tonight.
At its peak, the riot spread over 14 square miles of the city. A curfew was in effect, a complete ban placed on liquor sales. Gasoline could be purchased only during certain hours and never in a container. Offices, banks, schools, businesses, industry were closed down. The heart of Detroit was deserted. Deliveries were curtailed. Food ran short. All normal activities in the nation's fifth largest city were at a standstill. By Thursday, it had run its course. Troops were told to sheathe their bayonets. On Friday, the last major fire was reported. And on Friday, the president again addressed the nation.
There is no American right to loot stores or to burn buildings or to fire rifles from the rooftops. That is crime, and crime must be dealt with forcefully and swiftly, and certainly under law.
An 11-member commission was appointed to study the rioting, its causes and implications. It was the Kerner Commission. For Detroit, the Crimson statistics were totaled. 43 dead, untold thousands injured. No official figures could be kept. Nearly 2,000 fire runs, 7,231 arrests, and a dollar figure that totaled hundreds of millions. They had said it couldn't happen here, but it did, and left a bloody monument, the most devastating riot in the nation's history. And as it ended, Detroit's young mayor, Jerome Cavanaugh, viewed the ruins and looked to the future. He pointed to the city's motto, Resurgit Canaribus. It shall rise again from the ashes. And like the mythical phoenix, it would rise. The mayor appointed a 39-member committee. They called it New Detroit. He charged them.
We want today to build up this city from the ashes of the present conflict into the kind of urban environment in which every man and woman can say with dignity and self-respect that they're proud to be a Detroiter.
The makeup of the New Detroit Committee ran the gamut. Its chairman, 36-year-old Joseph L. Hudson, Jr., department store magnate. Members ranged from Henry Ford II and James Roach to leaders of the Negro community. New Detroit was successful in securing from Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler jobs for the underprivileged, and industry lessened standards to offer employment. The committee found tasks for young, and they strongly endorsed and fought for statewide open housing. To a special legislative session, the governor made an appeal.
In my opinion, it is absolutely essential to enable any American citizen to exercise the same rights as any other American citizen, and that applies in housing or any other field.
But open housing was not to be in 67. It did not pass and will be an issue in 68. In Detroit proper, an open housing ordinance came before the city's council. At a public hearing, there was strong support. Detroit's Archbishop, the Most Reverend John F. Dearden, said,
I ask you to pass this ordinance not because poor housing was judged to be one of the major underlying causes of last summer's revolt, nor from fear of more burning and violence, nor because it is politically expedient. I ask you to take this action because it is morally right.
And there was loud opposition, mostly from an ultra-right-wing group called Breakthrough, whose leader, Donald Lobsinger, assailed Negro council member Nicholas Hood.
Don't you like what I'm saying, Mr. Hood? Don't you like what I'm saying, Mr. Hood? Mr. Hood objects to my speaking any longer because Mr. Hood cannot stand the truth, you hypocrite.
Council approved the open housing ordinance, prohibiting discrimination in sale and rental and providing stiff penalties, said Councilman Hood.
Today we made history, whereas many people are making hysterical sounds. I think my colleagues joined with me in doing something very significant today.
As the year closed, however, a group of homeowners filed petitions containing 101,000 signatures to suspend the ordinance and put it on the ballot. The riot reverberations continued. Joseph L. Hudson said backlash could be a problem.
We've detected evidence of a backlash. Now, this is to be expected, but this must be minimized and met head-on if we're to wrestle with the conscience and arrive at some meaningful and legitimate solutions to the problems that this community faces.
A militant Negro leader, Reverend Albert Clegg, said the Negro wants control of the Negro community. Reverend Clegg was articulate in his explanation, but frightening in his implication.
Either there is a transference of power to the black community so that self-determination for the black community is possible, or black people have no alternative but to be violent and do anything else that's necessary, because any people have to have a power base upon which they operate.
Late in the summer, but not long after the rioting, H. Rapp Brown came to Detroit. His visit sparked fears, but only a comparative handful of Negroes chose to spend their Sunday listening to the Black Power firebrand. Brown wasted little time in his harangue.
You better quit running around here talking about loving these honkies to death. Do like they did during the American Revolution. They didn't love the British to death. They shot them to death. During rebellions, brother, you got to stop looting and start shooting.
Criticism continued in the wake of Detroit's outbreak. The charge, trigger-happy, was leveled at the National Guard. Federal authorities instituted riot training. And time and again, the question was raised, why hadn't police acted faster when the 12th Street incident grew? Said Police Commissioner Ray Girardin,
"We were at our lightest strength at the particular time this broke out, early Sunday morning, because usually the least is doing then, so we had the least men."
And the arch foe of the city's executives, Councilwoman Mary Beck, found new fuel in her daily battles with the mayor. The city's top man, said Miss Beck, was not where he should have been during July's rioting. During one council session, it went like this.
"To suggest that by reading the penal code or the city charter that I belong physically at Herman Kiefer 12th Street, I think is an exercise in the most ridiculous and ludicrous reasoning that I could possibly contemplate." "Well, Miss Beck, I'm not even going to respond to some of your absurdities."
Long before July, Miss Beck began a recall campaign, accusing the mayor of any and all failures. She circulated petitions. By year's end, there had been no recall and few progress reports from the flowered hat at the council table. There were other riot repercussions. Three police officers were charged in connection with the killings of three Negro youths at a motel on July 26th. One faces murder charges. The story of the year was without question the days of madness in July. But it's a story with no end. Imaginative and liberal leadership had led Detroit, and yet it happened here. There are lessons to be learned. If they aren't, the summer of 67 may have a rerun in 68.
A teaspoonful of gospel is not enough. We must do all that is necessary until the freedom and independence of Vietnam has been assured.
Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican, supporting administration Vietnam policy.
"It should be clear by now that the bombing of the North cannot bring an end to the war in the South. And indeed, at the present time, it may well be prolonging that war."
Senator Robert Kennedy, a Democrat opposing administration Vietnam policy. That dirty jungle war continued in the headlines through 1967, but in the year of turmoil, controversy over Vietnam reached new heights.
"Hell no, USA! Hell no, USA! Hell no, USA!"
Demonstrations became a way of life. They marched in protest everywhere. In October, a massive Washington demonstration was held. Many Detroiters went, among them a Wayne State University professor, David Hiroshoff.
"We do not go to Washington, D.C. as insular American liberals, hoping to reason with our friend in the White House. We go to confront the chief enemies of the people of the world, the Yankee imperialists and their commander-in-chief, the vulture from Texas."
Others, not so politically left, just did not believe in the draft. One was Marvin Atlas, who turned in his draft card at Detroit Selective Service Center and told WKNR,
"First of all, I think the carrying of the card is a violation of my constitutional rights. And secondly, I think that the Vietnam War is unequivocally wrong, and I cannot cooperate with it in any way."
So as the war progressed, the dissent increased. And President Johnson viewed the dissenters.
"And if I have done a good job of anything since I've been president, is to ensure that there are plenty of dissenters." And so what I would say is, let's realize that we're in the midst of a war. Let's realize that there are 500,000 of our boys out there that are giving their life to win that war. Let's ask ourselves what it is we can do to help. And if you think that you can make a contribution to helping them by expressing your opinion and dissenting, then do it.
One man who had taken more than his share from the protesters, Robert McNamara, threw in the towel. McNamara stepped down as Secretary of Defense to take the more serene post of President of the World Bank. In the war itself, more bombings and more battles. Strange names became a part of the average American's vocabulary. Doc Toe, Mekong Delta, Chu Lai, Dak San, and Hill 875. In December, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Earl Wheeler, addressed Detroit's Economic Club. Before WKNR microphones, General Wheeler assessed the war.
"I am convinced of four things. One,
we are winning the war in Vietnam. Two, I cannot predict when the war will end. Three, although the tide of battle is running against Hanoi, they are not yet convinced that they cannot win. And four, flowing from item three, Hanoi is not yet ready to negotiate an end to the war.
Late in the year, it was revealed that 15,000 Americans had died since we began participation. Another general, William Westmoreland, said the end was beginning to come in sight. There was another war in 1967. It lasted 6 days. The Mideast War saw Israel run rampant over Arab forces. To background the Mideast War would be to draw the chronology of centuries. Speaking at the United Nations, Israel's mellifluous Foreign Minister Abba Ibn noted,
I understand our neighbors would wish to turn the clock back to 1947. The fact is, however, that most clocks move forward and not backward. And this, I think, should be the case with the clock of Middle Eastern peace.
As 67 drew to a close, there was still no solution to the multiple problems that had led to that war in June.
When you recognize that people have misled you, you're much better prepared to prevent that from happening again. Nobody's going to brainwash me.
George Romney, Michigan governor and presidential candidate. During 1967, the governor had made many momentous decisions and several monumental bloopers. For most of the year, the governor continued his long, hard look, and in doing so, blurted out his now infamous brainwash statement, stating his thinking on Vietnam had changed because he'd been brainwashed on an earlier trip to Asia. It was fuel for his foes. But on November 18th, the governor said what everyone expected him to say.
I have decided to fight for and win the Republican nomination and election to the presidency of the United States. I've made my decision with great earnestness. I am concerned about America.
Shortly after, the governor left for a round-the-world trip, stopping at all major capitals, including Moscow, and visiting Vietnam. This time, he said, there was no brainwashing. On the Democratic side, the chairman of Michigan's Democrats, Zoltan Ferency, hit the political headlines with outspoken criticism of the president and a call for an open convention in Chicago.
There is a very serious risk, and you should all be aware of it, that by participating in this convention this morning, you will become outcasts in the minds of some people who hold power within the Democratic Party establishment.
Ferency finally quit his party post and told WKNR News,
well, as the titular leader, the wearer of that uncoveted ceremonial crown, I suspect that in the future I will be brought out on festive occasions like a object of art and displayed for all to see. But actually, in terms of statewide Democratic Party participation, it's going to be minimal.
Said Ferency he would support the efforts of Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy, who planned primary opposition to Lyndon Johnson. Was McCarthy's bid serious?
Well, I don't know whether it'd be a serious effort to unseat him. It would certainly have to be interpreted as a serious action in opposition to the policies of the president.
But in Washington, where the real power remained, a reporter asked the obvious.
Are you going to run next year?
I'll cross that bridge when I get to it, as I've told you so many times, Mr. Abbott.
There was turmoil between labor and management in 1967. For the auto industry, it was that time again.
We have made it very clear. We do not want more than our share, but we are determined to settle for nothing less than our share.
Walter Reuther, president of the United Auto Workers and top bargainer for the men on the line. It was a year for negotiating new contracts. It took 5 months, and Ford felt it first and worst.
We were most disappointed that the company, after 8 hours, came up with a letter that had the standards of a high school essay contest. And we were very disappointed. And because of their refusal to arbitrate, there's a strike in process.
Retorted an angry Henry Ford II.
I deplore the action of the UAW in forcing Ford into this situation. I am sorry that we do not have laws that effectively prevent the use of this kind of bludgeon against the public interest. But I do not for 1 minute regret our decision to take this strike rather than surrender to an unrealistic set of union demands.
But the 160,000 Ford workers at 91 installations remained off the job for a total of 61 days. Nearly $6 million a day in wages and benefits went down the drain. When it ended, the UAW leaders said it was worth it.
I'm very happy to announce, on behalf of myself and Ken Bannon and the National Ford Committee, that we have concluded a very historic agreement, and I salute and congratulate the Ford workers for the spirit and the solidarity which has made possible this great victory.
But all was not solidarity in the union. Skilled tradesmen were at odds with the leadership. They wanted more now. At a Ford council meeting, they let their feelings be known. WKNR's Eric Smith was there.
Mr. Ruth, are you surprised at that reception?
Look, there are 160,000 Ford workers on strike. Anybody can mobilize 25 people to shout no.
The Ford agreement was ratified. To the worker, the strike had won increases of over a dollar an hour for the next 3 years. To the Ford Motor Company, the cost was staggering. In the third quarter, the company reported losses of $74 million and was still struggling to win back lost sales. Next, the UAW went to Chrysler and General Motors. The pattern had been set, the contracts were reached, and Walter Reuther was happy.
It's a very rewarding thing, educating management. We go in there and they say insurmountable, impossible, impractical, unworkable, economically unsound, socially undesirable, and then we get them to do it.
For the UAW, it was another milestone year. There was other labor trouble around the nation. In July, the nation's railroads were shut down by machinists. The next day, Congress put through a bill to end it. A strike by steel haulers spread over 8 states. It lasted 9 weeks and was marred by violence. There was a rubber strike, and 50,000 workers in the copper industry walked out in midsummer. They're still out. And at the start of the school year, Detroiters and suburbanites alike were faced with a strike of another dimension. Teachers, thousands of them, hit the bricks, and school bells were silenced for 500,000 Michigan youngsters. The issue was simple: money. The districts affected ranged from the posh suburbs of Birmingham and Bloomfield to the downriver communities of Ecorse and Gibraltar. The biggest was Detroit. The militant lady leader of Detroit's Federation of Teachers, Mrs. Mary Ellen Reardon, defied the urgent pleadings of an already paying community, hailing her flocks to the sidewalks.
I'd like to make something very, very clear. We are not going on strike. We are taking an extended summer recess.
Said school spokesman, there was no money. Dr. Norman Drackler, superintendent of Detroit schools, put it this way for WKNR.
There isn't any money to meet both the demands made by the teachers as well as the services and commitments which we had made to the public in terms of additional teachers, reduction of class size, repairing of old buildings, and constructing classrooms. We simply cannot do both.
The teachers staged demonstrations, picketed, and drew the ire of weary parents and tired city officials, but the melody lingered long. As for the youngsters, vacation had lasted long enough.
Let's say they strike all year, then we're all going to be a year behind. Then what's the world going to come to if no one has school anymore?
Well, we pay a lot of taxes for this, and, well, they shouldn't get a raise every year.
They shouldn't, because we want to get back in school and not be dropouts like they are.
Nearly 2 weeks after the scheduled start of school, the break came. A new 2-year contract with an $850 raise and smaller classes. The teachers left the bricks and the kids hit the books. The end of the Detroit struggle did not signal the finale of other teacher walkouts. The Michigan Federation began needling the governor for his frequent out-of-state trips and lack of involvement in the strikes. At one point, union spokesman Tom Hill told WKNR,
"Last time I saw the governor was on television last week. He was judging a bubblegum contest at the Michigan State Fair. We would hope with 500,000 kids out that he would begin to work and get in here and do something about it."
Back in Michigan, the governor's fabled temper flared when he was accused of failing to keep promises to aid education. In a meeting with union officials, the governor's anger spilled.
Now, the thing you completely overlooked, and I resent it with all the intensity of my being, school aid support statewide has dropped to about 40% of total school expenditures in this state when I took public office. In the brief period I've been in public office, we've raised it to above 50%.
Finally, the Michigan teacher walkouts were settled, at least temporarily. In some areas, the teachers taught while the courts pondered the problems of public employee strikes. In June of 67, Detroit's finest stopped writing traffic tickets. The move was accepted gratefully by millions of Detroit drivers, not so by the mayor.
I don't propose to tolerate it. The commissioner has bent over backwards, literally, in the last several weeks in attempting to resolve this impasse. And since the Detroit Police Officers Association shows no inclination to do anything about it, we're going to take what action we can take.
The police were attempting to make a point. They were in a budding labor organization, the DPOA. They wanted, they said, more money, and the city didn't have it. 40 officers were sent back to walking a beat. Still, the ticket slowdown continued. And then a new virus suddenly appeared. They called it the blue flu. It reached epidemic proportions, but only among police. They called in sick by the hundreds. There was talk of National Guard and state police help. The city went to court. An injunction was issued, but it didn't work. In an interview with WKNR labor reporter Mike O'Neill, Police Association President Carl Parcell tossed the injunction aside.
The injunction says that the officers will not force the men into not writing tickets, and I never forced them into not writing tickets before. It says that I will not force them into getting sick, and I never forced them into getting sick. So the injunction actually doesn't mean anything. We haven't done anything like that to start with.
You mean an injunction can't stop a man from getting sick?
You said it, and that's right. An injunction cannot stop an officer from getting sick.
The blue flu spread, and Police Commissioner Girardin took action.
We've canceled furloughs and leave days, and our men are working 12 hours as a result of this unusual illness that seems to pervade.
Wives and children took to the sidewalks in support of the boys in blue, but the city held fast. There wasn't any money available. Finally, lengthy bargaining sessions produced an agreement on non-economic matters giving status to the union. And as for the money, that issue went to fact-finding. A report is still awaited to see if there's money to cure that rare disease, blue flu. On November 15th, the presses at the Detroit News rolled to a stop. The next day, the Free Press closed. A strike of Teamsters closed the news. Under a publisher's agreement, the Free Press voluntarily quit printing. There appeared little hope of an early resumption of publication. Late in the year, Teamsters turned down a final newspaper offer on wages. The shadow of a growing crime rate spread across Michigan, as it did the nation in 1967. The Attorney General, Frank Kelly, said it was organized.
We are establishing in the Attorney General's office an organized crime division. As far as I know, it will be the first of its kind in the nation. And it is being charged with the following responsibility: to mobilize all of the resources of law and law enforcement available to the state and to apply them with all the vigor we can muster against organized crime in Michigan.
The state's organized crime division had some success during the year, among them the breakup of a massive gambling ring. In Detroit, grocers were alarmed. Robberies were on the rise, and many storekeepers had been shot. They banded together, armed themselves, and even attended a gun clinic to learn the fine points. And they battled the bandits. But, said top cop Girardin,
I'm fearful of it because they're going to get themselves killed. Now, so far, in the last few weeks, the number of merchants who have shot the holdup people, the merchants are ahead.
The citizens clamored for protection. In Dearborn, a stop-and-frisk law was approved, allowing police to question anyone they suspected. Said the city's fiery mayor, Orville Hubbard,
I think the people are fed up way up above their earline of the muggings and the robberies and the murders and the hijacking and all this thing that's going on that's caused riots. I think all races of people feel that way about it.
The image of lawlessness continued to grow. The murder rate hit an all-time high. And of all the murders, none was more cruel than the deaths of two little sisters in the suburb of Westland. Debbie and Kim Crowther were brutally attacked, maimed, and strangled in a field near their home as they left school. A 14-year-old boy had been glue-sniffing before he trapped the girls. A shaken neighbor, Mrs. Mary Miller, told newsman Eric Smith the story.
What was it like back there, Mrs. Miller?
It was terrible. Their clothes all over and their shoes beside them, even their shoes and socks off.
What else was in the area? You mentioned something about glue tubes. There was
a yes, right over here about maybe 100 feet from where the bodies are. There was about 50 to 75 glue tubes at least.
Under the law, the 14-year-old could not be tried. He was committed to a juvenile home until he's 18. On the afternoon of December 4th, on Detroit's near west side, the siege on Stanford Street began. 62-year-old Eugene Ector, an auto worker, barricaded himself in his home. He was armed with an M1 rifle and a pistol. With him were his wife, her two daughters, a son, and a grandson. Ector fired several shots in the home and twice fired through the windows. Police cordoned off the area. An older daughter rushed to the scene. She crouched near the home using a police bullhorn.
Daddy! Daddy!
The poignant cries of the daughter helped. Ector agreed to allow other family members inside. But it would be 18 long hours before police were able to grab Ector and free the family. No one was hurt. Ector was committed. Friends said he had changed since a son was shot during the rioting. A son later found innocent of looting. Time was an issue in Michigan during the year. Congress had okayed a Uniform Time Act. All states were to go on daylight time unless the state legislature passed an exemption. Michigan's did. The pressure came from theater owners, restaurants, and mainly the Farm Bureau, whose president, Dan Reed, argued,
We're now on daylight saving time, really. We're on Eastern Standard Time, while 96% of the state of Michigan lies in the Central Time Zone.
In Detroit and other larger communities, daylight time was desired and some felt needed. Dwight Havens of Detroit's Board of Commerce.
All of our business procedures in general are tuned to an Eastern time zone. From our point of view, what with the remainder of the Eastern time zone going with the established Uniform Time Act, we'd like to see Michigan do same.
A petition drive to get the issue on the ballot was successful, and finally, nearly 2 months after the rest of the nation, Michigan's clocks were moved ahead an hour. People decide in November of 68. Most Michigan residents remember 1967 as the year the state took a bite of their paycheck. Fiscal reform finally came. A 2.6% levy on personal income. The first bite came in October. It raked in $24 million in the first month, and by next June, state officials hoped to net $171 million. For Governor Romney, it climaxed years of trying for fiscal reform. In the world of sports, the Detroit Tigers got the fans in the ballpark through the summer. They were in and out of first place for most of the season and never too far off the pace. And as the season was ending, the Tiger fans had their fingers crossed.
Tigers, my team. I don't care what nobody else say. I pull for the Tigers. Even when they're going down, I pull for them. Tigers are my team, and I just hope to be here. Where else can I go see a World Series?
Not Detroit. They lost the last game of the season and missed a playoff, and the Red Sox took the marbles. Later, the Cardinals took the Red Sox in the series. The Detroit Lions named a new coach, Joe Schmidt, and Mel Farr and Lem Barney took rookie honors with the Lions. Michigan State, once powerful, recorded the most disastrous season in 50 years. They won only 3 of 10 games. In April, an attractive middle-aged woman stepped off an airliner in New York. She was Svetlana Stalin, daughter of the late Russian dictator. She had defected communism in search of freedom. Would she become a citizen?
I think that before the marriage, it should be love. So if I will love this country and this country will love me, then the marriage will be settled, but I cannot say now.
Stalin's daughter later published a book. It told of the terrors of a totalitarian state. Another woman made news, Anne Pellegrino, a slight attractive blonde from Saline, Michigan. She flew a vintage 1937 airplane on the route taken by the late Amelia Earhart. The flight was successful. There was tragedy in the space race. The Russians lost cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov. a capsule burned on the launching pad at Cape Kennedy as tests were being made for the Apollo flight. Dead, astronauts Virgil Gus Grissom and Ed White, rookie Roger Chaffee. Chaffee's father summed it up as he said goodbye.
God bless you, Rog, Gus, and Ed. The price of progress comes high at times.
Many others won't be with us in 1968. Among them, Francis Cardinal Spellman, Harold Holt, Conrad Adenauer, John Nance Garner, Clement Attlee, J. Robert Oppenheimer, Carl Sandburg, Henry Luce, John Masefield, Bernard Fall, Dorothy Parker, Henry Kaiser and Alfred Krupp, Joseph Kowalski, Claire Hoffman, Harold Volkema, Ed Connor, Al Barber, Richard Weber, Joseph Gillis, James Nunley, Basil Rathbone, Paul Muni, Spencer Tracy, Vivian Lee, Misha Elman, Nelson Eddy, Claude Rains, Ann Sheridan, Bert Lahr, and Paul Whiteman. And the nameless are among the numbered. Some skydivers jumped over the wrong target and drowned in Lake Erie. A bridge collapsed at Point Pleasant, West Virginia. 36 bodies have been recovered. Airliners crashed in Ohio. In 1 month, 53 died. A department store fire in Brussels, Belgium, killed 129. Fire swept the aircraft carrier Forrestal. 34 sailors were killed. 1967 was also a year of flower children and paper dresses and microskirts and Boulder movies and LSD and marijuana. There was the permissive society. There were gurus and musical groups with names, Stone Ponies, Strawberry Alarm Clock, Lovin' Spoonful, and The Cream. And there was some question as to what was thrown off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And there were trips and happenings and people who blew their mind. But we managed all 12 months. There were other events that deserve mention. In Greece, where democracy was born, it died. There was a crisis over Cyprus. In Cleveland, Ohio, and Gary, Indiana, men named Stokes and Hatcher became mayor. They were Negroes. In California, the good ship Lollipop sank. Adam Clayton Powell and Thomas Dodd hit upon hard times. Che Guevara and George Lincoln Rockwell were gone. Cassius Clay said no to the army and lost a crown. An obstinate Congress said no to a surcharge unless the fiscal axe was wielded. It wasn't. There was Hollybush and Glassboro. A commissioner named Girardin retired. There was a highway department probe that didn't get off the ground. There were summer floods that caused problems, and there was a Detroit winter with more than 50 inches of snow. There was a New Orleans attorney named Garrison. There was a ship called the Torrey Canyon that sprung a leak and oiled the British beaches. There were fish called alewives in Michigan, and there was coho salmon. Le Grand Charles appeared at Expo and alienated many a Canadian. Lester Pearson called it quits. A pound was devalued. There was Louis Washkansky and a transplanted heart. There were Red Guards, and a Pope visited Fatima. And there was a marriage of a Marine and a maiden in the East Room. The hours catalog a year's living, a year's dying, a year's luck. 1967 was no different. For WKNR News, this is Philip Nye. This is Philip Nye. This is Philip Nye. This is Philip Nye. This is Philip Nye.